Okay, so let's start with our motivation. Again, with a sense of joy at having the opportunity to listen to the Dharma teachings, knowing that our life has continued up until now, which has been uncertain to have happened, but it has. And so that has given us the opportunity to listen to the teachings, think about them, practice them, and benefit from them. And so with that same kind of motivation, then let's again listen and think about the meaning of the teachings, especially this precious text by Aryadeva, the 400 stanzas, in which he is discussing the topic of emptiness, the ultimate nature of phenomena, which is the key to liberation for us. Sometimes I wonder, like, what would it have been like to live at Aryadeva's time, or to know Aryadeva, you know? And how did he write this text? Was he just teaching it to his disciples and somebody wrote it down, or did he sit there and think about it and then write it? And how in the world did he write something without a computer, without being able to, you know, change the order of the verses, change the words here and there? You know, was the scribe writing on banana leaves, or, you know, what kind of material? And who did he show it to? Or because it was so radical, dare he not show it to many people? It would have been interesting to get a sense of the person who wrote this. Usually when the Tibetans depict the great Indian sages, they're all in debating position. I'm going to smash your wrong views. Yeah, but, you know, I think there's probably more to them as people than that. Yeah, and His Holiness always jokes that you know, when the Tibetans paint them, they all have these big pandits, you know, these big yellow hats on. And he said they didn't have hats in India. Yeah, this is kind of Tibetan invention. So why do we make all the pandits, you know, dress up in clothes that they didn't actually have? Interesting. Okay, but they certainly were extraordinary living beings who really devoted their whole entire lives to the Dharma. And because of their devotion and dedication and writing the texts and meditating on them, actualizing the meaning, teaching them, doing all these Dharma activities, you know, then therefore the whole lineage exists today. And the teachings we have the text today, and the oral transmission also exists. And when you consider that this text was, you know, in Tibet, and in 1959 they had to leave very quickly, yeah, and that after that in Tibet libraries were burnt, then, you know, there must have been some people who, on their way out the door, grabbed the 400 stanzas, because this book, exactly as it is in the Tibetan tradition, doesn't exist in the Chinese tradition. They have a book called the 100, yeah, which has some of the same verses and the same topics, but it's clearly not the exact same text. Yeah.
Attributed to Aryadeva? Do they attribute it to
Aryadeva? Yeah. So it's, you know, very precious that we actually have this text, and that it's been translated into English, yet. It's not an easy text, you know. When the Tibetans, or when the Indians wrote, you know, these verses, the verses were very brief. They didn't write in whole sentences the way we speak, you know. And so there's, in any particular verse, there's many ways to look at it according to the meaning. And, you know, we have a translation here, and many of the verses really are quite, if we just picked up the verses without any commentary, how much would we really understand? So we're also indebted to Gelsenjie, who wrote the commentary on this. And then Ruth Sonam, who translated it, because Geshe Sonam Rinchen taught it, and he received it from Geshe Nawan Darge, who I also received it from. Yeah. So, quite a precious text. So we've been 400 stanzas. It's 16 chapters. Each chapter has 25 verses. Or 25 stanzas. And so we're just at the end of chapter 12 now. Okay, so we've done quite a bit. We're just going to finish up the topic of chapter 12, which was dispelling wrong conceptions, and especially looking at why people don't study emptiness from the viewpoint that the Buddha taught it. Or why they don't study emptiness, according also to how Nagarjuna taught it. Yeah. And so much in describing this is talking about, you know, people have their usual ways of thinking, and when they aren't really very bright in a Dharma way, then you know, the old views of inherent existence or the old perception of, you know, what we all perceive, just the way we perceive things, just gets taken for granted. And so they don't question that. And they don't, think about the teachings, you know. They don't ask, do things really exist in the way they appear to my senses? They just take that for granted. Okay, so that's due to a lack of intelligence, actually, you know, not questioning in that way. Okay, so we did verse 298 last time, yeah, where he is summarizing kind of the Buddha's teachings. He said in brief that Tathagatas explain virtue as nonviolence and emptiness as nirvana. Here there are only these two. Okay, so here it's talking about conduct and view. You know, we often come across those two terms when we're reading, you know, Buddha's conduct and Buddha's view. So the conduct is non-violence, non-harmfulness. The Sanskrit word is ahimsa. This is what Gandhiji also practiced. Okay, so not harmfulness, so that's the principal way of conducting ourselves in the world. And then the view is one of emptiness, you know, the lack of inherent existence. In other words, things do not exist with their own independent essence or nature, the way they appear to us to exist. And the way we, you know, assume they exist. We go along with that appearance, okay? And so this text is really questioning that appearance. So verse 299 says, to ordinary people, their own position, like their birthplace, is attractive. Why would you find attractive that which precludes it? Meaning precludes liberation. Okay, so this verse deals with why non-Buddhists don't appreciate the Buddha's doctrine. Okay, so Joe Blow, who asked questions, says, when outsiders, in other words non-Buddhists, are aware of the Buddha's teachings, why don't they appreciate these two principles of nonviolence and emptiness? Yeah? It's a good question. Yeah? Because after all, we look at these, and they're the best things, and everybody should believe them. But not everybody does. Okay? So, you know, we can't be too... we shouldn't be like a foot... rooters for a football team when it comes to our practice and our view and just saying it's best because it's mine. But, you know, really looking. And when you think, non-harmfulness is a good way to live. Yeah, it's not just... we don't believe that simply because the Buddha said it, but we would look. I mean, what would happen if there were no harm being done from one person to another person in the world today? Things would be very different, okay? The benefit of the view of emptiness is a little bit harder to see, yeah? But if we look and we see, oh, okay, things do not exist solidly the way they appear, therefore I don't need to get so attached to them, I don't need to have so much aversion to them, because actually they're just a collection of parts. Yeah, when we see things like that, oh, it's just a collection of parts, then we don't get so attached to it. Or when we see something as existing simply through imputation, then again we don't take things so seriously. And I think here a good example is money, you know. If somebody put $100 bill or a few $100 bills on the table, our instant reaction is, who do they belong to? Finders, keepers, losers, weepers. You know? And, oh, what can I do with this money? And, you know, we look at it and automatically this kind of greed comes, wanting to possess it. Yeah? But what really is the money if we look? It's paper and ink. Yeah. It's not even backed by gold, but actually that doesn't even matter. Even if it's backed by gold, who cares? What can you do with gold? You can't eat it. Yeah, you can't build a house out of it. You can't wear it. You can't use it as medicine. It's useless. Yeah, and people only value gold because they decided to. There's nothing inherently valuable in gold. And even we took away the gold standard, there's nothing inherently valuable in a piece of paper, you know, with Ben Franklin on it. Yeah, it's only valuable because we imputed value on it. From its own side, there's zero value. Yeah? So, you know, when you start to see things like that, then it's like, oh, well, what am I grasping at? It's just paper and ink. It only has value because we decided it has value. Yeah? And if you were stranded on a desert island, it would be useless. Yeah? You couldn't even use it as toilet paper. It's too rough, too stiff. Yeah? You'd probably trade all your $100 bills for a roll of toilet paper on a desert island, because that would be more useful to you. Okay? So, to the question, you know, why don't people appreciate the Buddha's teachings on nonviolence and emptiness? The response is because they're attached to their own... they've been attached to their own mistaken views since beginningless time. Okay, you know, and this is actually, it acts as a warning for us because we grew up with certain views and that were instilled in us when we were quite little, and we may not be totally free of the mind somehow adhering to those views. Yeah, there was somebody here who came recently who was brought up Catholic, and, you know, when he was telling us when he was little, like the fear of hell was really, you know, he was really told to be afraid of hell. And even though now he's a Buddhist, still that comes up for him as an impediment, is this kind of panic irrational feeling, fear of hell, because that's what he was taught as a child. Yeah, and that's just something coming from this lifetime. Yeah, and so, you know, we really need to question all these things and deconstruct them. And then when we see that they don't make any sense on a rational level, yeah, then to drop them and to really keep reminding ourselves again and again, this does not make sense. This cannot exist in this way. Yeah, in order to really let go of some of these old conceptions that we've had since we were quite young. Okay, so like people's homes, they like it. They don't want it. They don't want to really, you know, give it up, you know, because of attachment. So that's the kind of views that we have, you know, because of attachment, we hold on to something because it's familiar. If I can diverge for a minute, I was thinking about this a few days ago. And, I know the context. I was thinking, because I used to go visit my dad in Southern California, and then I would take walks in his neighborhood. And I thought, you know, since my dad died a couple of months ago, I won't be doing that so much, you know, going there and taking walks in the neighborhood. And then this little feeling of nostalgia came up. Like, oh, you know, I won't be taking walks in the neighborhood. And then I said, but I never really liked that neighborhood so much to start with. Yeah? Yeah? It wasn't my type of neighborhood. I mean, it was beautiful, but it wasn't my type of neighborhood. And then I thought, wow, why is this little bit of attachment nostalgia coming up? And I thought, just because it's familiar. Just because I had done it before, and the thought of, oh, I won't do it again, you know, then makes that little bit of, you know, nostalgia come up. And then I said, but that's stupid. I didn't really enjoy it that much. And then it really hit me, you know, at the time of death, we should not head for what's familiar. Yeah, that something being familiar is not a good reason to support it and go for it and follow it. Yeah? And I mean, this was a good example of it. So just because something's familiar, yeah, doesn't mean it's the best thing for us or that it's correct or anything. So this verse is really pointing that out, you know. We could have learned some kind of wrong view, and simply because it's familiar, we go towards it. Yeah? As we do with, you know, certain emotional reactions. Yeah, somebody spoke in a certain tone of voice, we automatically, some emotional reaction comes without questioning at all what is going on for the other person. Yeah, we just have all these assumptions and instantaneous reactions that actually get us into a lot of trouble. Yeah, so don't go towards the familiar unless you're sure it's something virtuous. If it's virtuous and it's familiar, go towards it. But we need to have that mind that can discriminate. Okay? So these people who reject the Buddhist teachings find these two principles of nonviolence and emptiness contrary to their own position, and their own position is very familiar to them. And so they don't follow the Buddha's teachings because they cling to their own wrong views. Yeah? And, you know, so that's why, in a certain way, you know, you have to be at a certain point in your life where you can really take in the Buddha's teachings. And until you get to that point, you may hear them, but you may not take them in. And you may push them away, and they may seem very, very strange to you. Yeah. So, for example, if you're somebody who really has a very strong belief in a creator, when you hear teachings, you know, that refute a permanent creator or teachings on emptiness, you just go, what kind of strange thing is that, you know? And you put it by the side because it doesn't go along with what you believe. Yeah? And so this happens with many, many kinds of things. So for somebody to really meet the Dharma and have some interest and appreciation for it, it has to be at a certain time in their life when there's some receptivity. Yeah? So that's why we have to be extremely sensitive about, you know, how we express the Dharma when we talk to people and not just assume, oh, it makes sense to me, it should make sense to the world. Yeah. Okay, then verse 300, the intelligent who seek what is good adopt what is worthwhile even from others. Does the sun not belong to all on earth who have sight? Okay, so this verse is about advising those who seek liberation to adopt good explanations. So it's kind of a verse saying to, you know, some of these people who shy away from the Buddha's teachings, you know, that if it's a good teaching, even though it's somebody else who said it, and not the leader of your religion or not the person that you're familiar with, if it's something reasonable and it makes sense and it's beneficial if you practice it, you should follow it, you know, and not just say, well, this wasn't taught by my system or I don't know anything about this. But, you know, think about things first, okay? So wise people who see their home as a reason for their problems leave it and go and settle in a prosperous place. So if you see the place where you're stuck having disadvantages, then it's easier for you to leave and adopt something new. Okay? So similarly, intelligent people seek what is good and adopt these points that facilitate the attainment of upper rebirth and liberation once they have become familiar with them, even though these are ideas from others' texts, from religions that they may not be, you know, from Buddhism, which they did not grow up with or are not familiar with. Okay? And so the analogy here was like the sun. So just like the sun is unbiased and it spreads its light to everywhere and belongs equally to all, so similarly, the practice of these two principles of non-harmfulness and emptiness can benefit everybody without discrimination. So it's fitting to practice them and appreciate them. And then there's a summarizing stanza. Okay, this is from Gyaltsebje, I believe. He says, become a proper vessel for good explanation and learn in the non-inherent and learned, let me start again, become a proper vessel for good explanation and learned in the non-inherent existence of dependent arising, the final object of the path that severs worldly existence, the understanding of which frees from attachment to extreme views. So here he's saying, you know, what is it that is the final object that severs all worldly, you know, attachment and that frees us from attachment to all the extreme views? Yeah, he didn't just say emptiness. And he didn't say just dependent arising. He said the non-inherent existence of dependent arising. Okay, again, bringing dependent arising and the emptiness of inherent existence together as something compatible so that you can still assert the existence of conventional truths as dependent phenomena and also see that they do not exist the way they appear because they lack inherent existence. Okay, so that's the view that he's guiding us towards. Okay, now we're going to go. So that chapter wasn't too difficult. Yeah, it gave us a little respite, didn't it? Now we're going to chapter 13. Okay, chapter 13 is a bit more difficult. Chapter 14 is even more difficult. Okay, so chapter 13 is refuting truly existent sense organs and objects. Okay, so it's looking at how perception takes place. And usually for perception to take place, we say there's an object, something that's cognized. There's a sense power or a sense organ, you know, like the eye, ear, nose, tongue, tactile sense, mental sense. Okay, so there's an organ. And then there's a consciousness, yeah, that actually perceives. And these three, yeah, function together. We usually feel like there's an inherently existent object, you know, there's a package of tissues out there, okay, totally separate, not dependent on me whatsoever, okay. And then there's my eye organ, also inherently existent, it's just an eyeball sitting there as an eyeball with the capacity to perceive things from its own side. Yeah. And then there's a moment of consciousness that also truly existent, you know, a moment of consciousness that's just sitting there waiting to perceive something. Okay, that's the way it seems to us, doesn't it? Yeah. That these are three completely separate things. And then all of a sudden, when you put the pack of tissues and, you know, the eye sees them, then the consciousness arises. And, you know, we're perceiving this object out here that's totally different. Okay, that's the way it appears to us. You know, what he's getting at is that that's not the way things exist. Okay? And actually, it's quite interesting because even to posit object, sense faculty, and consciousness, you can't posit one without the other two. Yeah? How can you posit a visual consciousness without there being a visual object and a sense power that sees color and shape? Yeah? And how can you posit something as a sense power if there weren't an object and the consciousness that is engendered by that sense power? And how could you talk about something being an object, a visual object, unless there were a sense power and a consciousness perceiving it? Okay? So when we actually think about it, these three are established independence upon one another. However, when we usually look at them or think about them, they seem like three unrelated things. Okay? So, this chapter is the extensive explanation of the reasoning refuting true existence, and here particularly the true existence of that which is apprehended, the sense objects. Okay? Okay. So verse 301. When seeing its form, the whole pot, is not in fact seen. Who that knows reality would claim that the pot is directly perceptible also. Okay. So, this starts out, yeah, Joe Blow says, okay, in stanza 300 that we just finished, it said the intelligent who seek what is good adopt what is worthwhile even from others. So what is the good explanation? And Aryadeva says it's about seeing phenomena as empty of true or inherent existence. And so Joblo says, it's impossible to cognize that all phenomena have no inherent existence, because in that case they would be totally non-existent and not directly perceptible, perceivable. Okay. However, since a pot is an object and blue is a color, are directly perceivable, all functioning things are inherently existent. Okay. So why is Joe Blow saying this? What's he confusing? He's confusing existence and inherent existence, saying that if it doesn't inherently exist, then it doesn't exist whatsoever.
Which he's confused before.
Yeah, Joe Blow's always confused about this point. This point comes up many times in the text, doesn't it? Yeah. Because it so happens that we too are confused about this point. That's why it keeps coming up so much. Okay. Because Joe Blow says, you know, if they don't inherently exist, then they don't exist at all. In which case, you can't even talk about them being objects that are directly perceived. However, according to our experience, since a pot and blue are directly perceivable, yeah, they and everything, all the other functioning things, must inherently exist. Okay? So Aryadeva says, well, Joe Blow, we've been through this many times before, but just remember that it's impossible, you know, that a direct perceiver, a direct perception of a pot that is inherently existent is not possible. You can't directly perceive an inherently existent pot. Why? Because such a thing doesn't exist. Okay. So if the pot were inherently existent, or here they use the term existing by its own entity, it means the same thing. Okay. If things did exist that way, then the awareness seeing the visible form of the pot should perceive all of its parts. Now you're going, why, if you see the form of the pot, would you have to perceive all of their pot, all of the parts of the pot? Okay. So, let's look at our old friend, the cup, here. Okay. If this cup existed by its own nature, okay, when we look at it, it looks like this whole thing is a cup, doesn't it? Yeah. It's not that one part of it is a cup. This is a cup through and through. Each part of it, you know, is the whole, you know, the whole thing is a cup. That's it.
Is the cover a cup?
Huh?
Is the cover a cup?
Depends how you define cup. We can take the cup top off. Okay. Okay. So, but it looks like this whole thing is a cup through and through. Yeah, that it has its own essence, independent of anything else, that is a cup. Okay. So if this were a cup through and through, then every single little part of it is a cup. Because this is a cup through and through. It's not like when you look at it, you say, oh, this part's a cup, but this part isn't a cup. You look at it, the whole thing's a cup. It's a cup through and through. If that were the case, then, I mean, there's cup nature in each part of it. So if there's the nature of cupness in each part of it, yeah, then, and each part of it would then be a cup, then when you saw one part of the cup, you would say, I see the cup. And the cup is equally existent in the part that you don't see, so you should be seeing that too, because that's also the cup. Do you get what I'm saying? Yeah? It's kind of a weird way of looking at it, but logically, that's the way it should be. If this whole thing had cup nature through and through, then the whole thing has cup nature. So that means each part has cup nature. Yeah. And when you saw one part and you said, I see the cup, you don't, when you look here, you don't see, I see part, you don't say, I see part of a cup. You say, I see the cup. Yeah. So all the other parts are also equally as cup as the part that you see. So since you're seeing the cup, you should also see all these other parts that aren't immediately visible to you from the angle that you're looking at it from. Okay? So if the cup were inherently existent, that's the way it should work like that.
You should also just feel that handle and see a whole cup.
Yeah. Right, you should, you know, see a whole cup in any particular piece because it had cup nature through and through. So if the cup were inherently existent through and through and existed in all the parts, even if you separated the parts, they would still have the nature of cup in them, which would mean when you saw the individual parts, you should see the cup. And since that part is the cup, and the cup is in all the parts, when you saw one part, you should also be seeing all the other parts at the same time.
If it were like that, it would be those parts would be inseparable.
Well, this is part of the contradiction, isn't it?
Right.
You know, because then you would have to say, well, do you have many pots, many cups there, or only one cup? If you say that there's only one cup, then all the parts would have to go into one. If you say that there's many pots, many cups there, then all you have to do is put this on the table and everybody has something to drink from. You know? And that's not going to go over so well. Yeah, I wouldn't make a business plan based on that. Okay, so, yeah, you should, so a pot that exists with its own essence is one whole individual, indivisible pot. In that case, the pot would be in all of its parts. In that case, seeing one part, you should see the pot, and seeing the pot, you should see all of the parts. Okay? So you should when you should see all of the parts when you see one part. Okay? But the visual consciousness perceiving the pot's form, okay, doesn't perceive every single part of the pot. Yeah, or of the cup or whatever it is. Okay. So in that case, what person that knows the reality of things would claim that a pot that exists by its own essence, by its own nature, is directly perceivable? You can't see such a thing. Okay. So similarly, blue, you know, when the verse says, blue is, you know, this pertains, they're using a pot, but it also means blue, it means smell, you know, it refers to all these things. Okay, so a pot is imputed in dependence upon the eight substances. So this is, remember when we study the Vibhasikas, They have all these different atoms, you know, the earth, water, fire, air atoms, and then those are the great elements, and then the elemental derivatives, okay, so the color atom, the smell atom, the taste atom, the tactile atom, the sound atom. The sound atom isn't there with everything, but it is not.
Yeah,
it's not with everything, okay? So they're saying that, you know, a pot is imputed in dependence upon the eight substances, so therefore it can't exist, you know, by its own characteristics, with its own essence. Now, you might say, well, we don't believe in the eight substances, you know. Science doesn't look at things as, you know, there being a particle of color and a particle of smell and things like that. But similarly, you know, when we look at anything, is it just one of its characteristics? Yeah. When we look at the pot, the cup, the cup has many different attributes, many characteristics. It has color, it has shape, it has smell, it has taste, it has a tactile sensation. So it's made up of many different attributes, many different characteristics. We may not see those things as being small particles that are put together, but the point is the same, that you just have a collection of attributes, and in dependence upon this, we impute pot. So it's an interesting thing to sometimes try and train yourself, because we usually go, oh, the pot, the cup, and the cup has color, it has taste, it has all these things. Like the cup is the possessor, or like the cup is the thing, there's all these qualities and the cup is what holds them all together. Okay? But look at it the other way. You have different colors coming together. You have the attribute of hardness. You have the characteristic of a certain shape. Yeah, a taste, a certain texture. Yeah, a certain smell. You have all of those characteristics together. And in dependence upon that, we say there's a cup. Look at it that way. Does the cup appear different to you if you do it that way? Yeah? If you think, okay, let's just bring all those things together, all those attributes together, and then, oh, yeah, there's a cup. But is the cup any of those attributes? Yeah? Is the cup its color? You know? Well, no, because we look at cup, the cup is the, it's this, you know, it's the hardness. But hardness is just an attribute. Can hardness be a cup? If you just had hardness, yeah, or if you just had smooth texture, yeah, or even just the shape, would you have a cup?
If it was the shape, you could draw it and you would have a cup.
Yeah, exactly. If it were the shape, you could draw it and then you could use it to drink from. Okay. If it were the smell, you could have the smell and then you would have a cup. Or you could have the colors. Yeah, just the colors there with no hardness. Or you have hardness, but there's no colors and there's no shape. Yeah? So when you start to break it down into pieces, you know, I find this is what I do in retreat break time. You know, I sit somewhere and I just look at what's around me and start to break it down like this. And then you see, oh, well, you know, there's a bunch of attributes there, but none of them are the cup. So how do I drink out of a cup? Yeah? Am I drinking out of the color, the shape, the hardness, the smoothness, the smell, the taste. What am I drinking out of? Yeah? Oh, I'm drinking out of the cup, but what is the cup? Because when I look in this, I can't find a cup. So how do all those different attributes, they give the appearance of a cup, and I'm drinking out of the appearance of a cup. You know, this sounds like Fantasia. Yeah? Remember that movie? We should watch that movie sometime, you know? It really seems like it's magic, doesn't it? How in the world do I drink out of a cup? There is no cup there. Okay?
Well, just don't analyze it, then you can drink. Yeah,
and that's the point. That's the point. When you analyze, you can't find it. When you don't analyze, you can drink out of it. You know, if that doesn't seem like magic, yeah? Doesn't that seem like magic? I'm going to drink out of it. But it, you know, it. What happens if there's no cup there and all the water falls all over me?
You have to start analyzing the water. Oh.
So what did you just drink out of?
I don't know. I drank out of a cup, but I'm not sure exactly what the cup was. That's why I said, you know, if I can't find anything in here that's the cup, how do I know it's going to hold the water? So does that mean that the water's going to fall out?
Did you actually drink?
Yes. What is the drink when the water goes touches your lips, when it's in the back of your mouth, when it goes down your throat? At what point are you drinking the water?
And what did you actually drink?
Yes. And what did I actually drink? Okay.
No wonder they thought everything was non-existent.
Yeah. That's quite... Okay. So, then there's a whole bit here about dialecticians, you know, which is one kind of essentialist. I don't want to really go into their whole argument, basically because I don't understand the whole thing. I'm telling you the truth. Okay, but it says they contradict reasoning and common knowledge when they say that an awareness arising in dependence on an individual on individual sense organs is a direct perception. Okay, and they say that an awareness free of conceptuality, oh, it goes into sound in image and generic image suitable to be mixed. We're not going to talk about that. That, I mean, just it goes way off into a tangent that I don't think it's useful. Okay, let me go back here. So dialecticians, when they talk about a direct perceiver, they have three features of it, which Chandrakirti refutes. Okay, so the three features are, it's a consciousness free from conceptuality, it's unmistaken with respect to its appearing object, and which is a functioning thing that exists from its own side, and both arising and engaging in its object, it both arises and engages in its object in dependence on a sense organ. Okay? So that's what they say is a direct perceiver. And this is kind of how we learned it when we studied Lohrig, isn't it? When we studied mind and awareness. Yeah? This is the text that you were referring to. Okay? So while the Satrantikas say that a direct perceiver is a consciousness free from conceptuality, in other words, it's not seeing things through a conceptual appearance, Chandrakirti refutes that. Okay, yes, it sounds funny, doesn't it? Because we're so used to, but a direct perceiver sees it directly, and there's no conceptual process in there. Because that's how we learned it. You see what's familiar is what we go to. Okay, but here, okay, for Chandrakirti, a conceptual consciousness can be a direct perceiver because the direct perceiver means it doesn't rely on a logical mark. It doesn't rely on a reason in a syllogism. So it doesn't have to be something conceptual. So the second moment of an inference can be a direct perceiver because it's perceiving what you realized in the inference without relying on the reason, because the first moment of the inference relied on the reason. The second moment is a subsequent cognizer. So it's just continuing on from that. It's not directly relying on the reason. So that's why Chandrakirti says that a direct perceiver, or that a conceptual consciousness can be a direct perceiver.
But you know, when Jeffrey went over that, he used that word direct, and he used even direct perceiver at first, and then we kind of got away from that word because we couldn't take that point. You know what I mean? It seems like it was a different usage of the words.
Well, he is. He's defining direct very differently here.
Yeah,
because Chandrakirti didn't agree with everything Dindaga and Dharmakirti said. He really disagreed on a lot of things. So here we're coming into one of them. So when you get into it, when you start studying the tenet systems, when it comes to the Prasangika and they talk about object possessors, the things that perceive objects, they start mentioning all of this. And at first when you look at it, you're going, what are they talking about? But then when you start to see, oh, it's just using a different definition for the word direct. Okay, it means, yeah. Subsequent moments of inference are direct perceivers because they don't rely on a reason to cognize their object. Okay, it remembers the object inferred directly. In other words, without renewed reliance on a reason. Then the second thing the dialectician said was that a direct perceiver was unmistaken with respect to its appearing object. Now, why do you think Chandrakirti would refute that? Why isn't that true?
Because it appears as truly existent.
Exactly. It appears as truly existent, and that's a mistaken appearance. Okay. And then the third quality is that it arises and engages in, the direct perceiver arises and engages in its object in dependence on a sense organ. Okay. And as far as I understand what Chandrakirti is using to refute that, he says each individual moment of consciousness cannot be a direct perceiver because it can't arise and then engage in its object independence on a sense organ, as they assert, occurs in a direct perceiver. And that is because in each moment, both the sense organ and the consciousness cease upon arising. Okay? So because things are momentarily ceasing, 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 they're arising, abiding, and ceasing all at the same time, you can't say that a sense consciousness arises and engages in the object, that one moment of sense consciousness. Yeah, you need the previous moment, and you also need a series of moments of mind in order to have a perception. Yeah, you need that previous moment, you need the first moment of contact, you know, I mean, the smallest moment, we can't, you know, when they divide it into, what is it, 1/65th of the finger snap, that alone can't perceive. You know, it's too quick. We need a whole gathering of moments in order to perceive something. Okay? Okay, so they say that an extensive explanation of this is found in Chandrakirti's commentary on the 400. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which I think that Geshe Eshi Thubke was referring to, you know, when he was teaching on it. Okay, so we will stop for today right here. Yeah. Not so easy, this one, this part. Okay? Yeah, especially when they get into their view of things being, you know, made of these eight different particles, then, it, you know, you have to kind of really believe in the eight particles for all the arguments to make sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah? So for us, it automatically, you know, you kind of have to, we may have to provisionally believe and, you know, take that in order to understand the argument, and then try and use the same kind of reasoning according, you know, to and apply it to the way science explains things now.
Yeah.
But even, you know, if you really think about the way science explains things, it would really help, because from a scientific view, yeah, the color doesn't exist here in the object. Yeah. It only has color because light is striking it and reflecting in a certain way. And that the light that's reflecting is coming in contact with the eye sense power.
And then everybody's eye sense power sees a different red.
Yeah.
It's not
the yeah, so see. So we're not actually seeing it here. The you know, the light rays that are getting reflected from here are what's touching there. So we're you know, there's the light rays interacting with the sense power, and then we have an appearance of a color. It's just an appearance of a color, isn't it? Where actually is the color? Is the color in the light waves? We think the color's here, but if the color were there and there were no light waves hitting it, we wouldn't be able to see any color. So how could we even say there was a color here? What we're actually seeing is the light waves. Yeah. So then when you think of it like that, then it really seems even more empty, doesn't it? Yeah. Because that's completely taking away the idea that the color's out there. You know, and really accentuating that the color arises only as an appearance due to the light rays touching the rods and cones in the retina and certain, you know, electrical things going up in our synapses.
Can I ask a question about this teaching, one of the third thing that Chandrakirti repeats? When it says the direct perceiver both arises and engages its object, does that is engages a synonym for apprehends?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's kind of yeah, it has to engage.
Okay.
Yeah. It's pretty I would say it's pretty synonymous with apprehend. Okay. So, to be continued.
Dialecticians.
Yeah, but they're a kind of essentialist. It isn't real clear which kind of essentialist mm-hmm. they are. Because in one way, this sounds very much like Satantrika, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Satantrika. I don't know. I'll have to look that up.
Yeah.
Okay.
Dear spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losam's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Gurana Mandala Kam Niryataya Me. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezig, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders who spread the view of dependent arising and non-violent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the west floor.